the Buddha, it's the Dharma, it's the Sangha. So I want to talk a little bit more about grounding, keeping our spiritual grounding, and about some of the things to kind of watch for as signals that our grounding is getting shaky, and what to do about it. Because the signals are, you know, basically there to help if you know how to read them and make the necessary adjustments. One of the traditional ways of talking about the phase of training that I think that we're all in at the present time one of the metaphors that's traditional is to talk about a simmering like pot of herbs or a simmering soup pot. And, you know, if you imagine you put a lid on it, well, it can not only simmer, but you can actually build up steam in there and the lid can start clattering around. And this is a necessary aspect of training, a necessary phase. Ramesh used to talk about it as cooking the karma. And sometimes things get lively in the process. There's many ways in which they get lively. What we want to do is let them simmer, let things simmer away and let it be as lively as it needs to be, but try to keep it from getting so lively that things are popping out of the pot onto the ground around the pot. Reverend Master used to say that the chief signals and the chief obstacles that hit at a time like this are very simply sex and anger. And we can it's helpful to look at, you know, kind of what the spiritual meaning of these two things is. You could describe a sexual urge as the kind of fundamental greed, and it's kind of built into us. If you think about it, you know, you got to have, in order for us to live, you know, we're part of a living species. The species has to survive, so it's not surprising that the sexual urge is a very powerful one, physically most powerful generally in the young, but it has a mental component that goes on our whole life. And it always has at least the potential to get kind of activated, as it were. If you think about anger for a moment, anger is being impatient. Anger is kind of impatience taken to the nth degree. It's wanting to, just as the sexual urge is the urge to get a particular object at all costs, at its most kind of primeval level, and it really is at all costs. Think about the salmon swimming up the stream in order to spawn and then dying. Think about the stags that, you know, grow antlers and then have at it until sometimes they, you know, one of them or both of them die even. You know, in the primeval level, it kind of is the most powerful urge there is. And anger has a corresponding kind of power when it's impatience taken to the furthest degree. Because then it's basically, anger is basically the urge to eliminate anything that's an obstacle to what I intend to do. So, the sexual urge is the most primeval level, is the urge to keep the species going at all costs. The anger at the primeval level is to remove the obstacle at all costs. So not surprisingly, anger can turn into a truly destructive hatred, and if it's allowed to do so, of that which is perceived as the obstacle. Anyway, one reason to talk about, bring hatred in so soon, when I haven't really finished talking about sex, is that you can't deal with sex through hatred. Nor can you deal with hatred through hatred. That you have to use the middle path to deal with these things, to not be kind of swept away in the power of them. Obviously, most of the time, most of us experience more subtle forms of these things. But don't ever delude yourself that you're not basically an animal. Because we all are. And it's really, we're all capable of doing things that, you know, humans are justifiably ashamed of. So these are things we really want to watch. And to watch them in the context of a meditative and fundamentally compassionate, same thing really, meditative and compassionate point of view. Because when any part of ourselves, and these are, you know, part of our makeup as human beings, when any part of ourselves is treated with scorn or hatred, or perceives itself to be treated with scorn or hatred, it goes ballistic. So there's no more sure way of driving yourself into further extremes if you're already struggling than to despise that part of yourself that is having a hard time, or with which you're having a hard time. So, you know, what can one do instead? First step, put the protective ring of the precepts around it. That's the first step. Put the protective ring of the precepts around whatever it is. And the best way I know to do that is to actually turn to the Eternal and ask for help with that. I learned that in 1998 when in the early months of the weeks and months of the retreat I was doing, when the karma was coming up, when the past lives were lined up and coming up, and some things from this life as well, and come up incredibly powerfully, and feeling just what someone else felt, and just praying not to get swept away by it. And that's where I really learn to pray. Please help me not to get swept away by this. Please help me to hold fast. So you can invoke the particular precept that applies and ask the Eternal for help with it. And to me, of course one can only speak for oneself in this, but for me, this has made a huge difference to learn that I can ask for help in keeping the precepts. And that it's not just me on my own. that putting the ring of the precepts around it is the first thing, because that sets the word, that sets the limits. No, it can't go beyond this. You know, it can't go. I'm not going to let you go beyond this point. For the purpose of not doing harm to oneself and others. You know, the first pure precept. First, do as little harm as you can in the circumstances. The second step is to actually, once one has that ring and the precepts around it, to actually really open one's heart and make the offering to the eternal of that particular passion or feeling, state of mind. And that is a really painful thing, because then you, when you do that, you really open yourself to it and you really feel the pain of it. And that's also where the eternal can really get at it, because you've kind of pried your heart open to it. Now the eternal can get at it. Of course, that's the second column. That's why, you know, the teachings on reharmonization say, you know, the eternal brings to that which is difficult to bear. They'll say to bring, what is it? How's it go? The eternal brings to, well, the brings to the obstacle, let's put it that way. That which is difficult to bear, it's cleansing water of compassion. And you go, well, you know, why should the cleansing water of compassion be that which is difficult to bear? But in the beginning stages of that second column, that's exactly what it is. One experiences the pain of it. And that feeds back into the limit you've set around it. Because as soon as you let yourself actually experience the pain of it in that way, and you've offered to the eternal, it diffuses the thing. It takes all the wind out of its sails. So that it just can't run rampant. So you have the protective fence is way of the precepts, the protective ring of the precepts. You're taking refuge in that ring and keeping everything pinned in there so it can't just run rampant and carry away with it. And you have the power of compassion, really, which is you first experience it as you're opening your heart to it, but it's the opening of the heart in the offering. Because the compassion with the big C is what has to come from the eternal. You know, I am not Kanzeon. I can turn towards Kanzeon and ask for help. And let's just turn back a step now. Well, why should, you ask yourself, well, why should sex and anger figure so big when there's so many other things, you know, at key times? Well, if we look at sex, you know, there is just that kind of primeval urge to reproduce. But you really can't divorce any part of existence from, and any part of our lives, any part of ourselves from the fundamental issue of love. What it is to give love and to receive love. And this is true of nothing more than it is of sex. You can't divorce sex from love and the sexual urge from the longing for both to love and to give love and to receive love. this thing that people, you know, they convince themselves they can do that and behave foolishly as a result, but you actually can't. So that, you know, that the genetics, it's love that explains sex, actually, because the sexual longing is fundamentally the longing both to give and to receive love. And although it has a powerful physiological aspect, it's far more than that. And what is it that that anguished karma deep within us is confused about? It's, you know, where's the love? That's its question. Where's the love? How do I connect back up with that love that in some sense, in some way I feel I've lost? That's a question in every one of these, you know, when people see their past lives, that's in there. That's always in there. In many aspects, perhaps, but it's always in there. Feeling cut off from love. So, sexuality is a very powerful way in which beings try to reunite with love. And so, not surprisingly, when we're at a real low ebb, we can sometimes really get slugged with sexual longing. Sometimes it's more just kind of a head level, kind of a kind of delusory and illusory fantasies or thoughts passing through. Sometimes it's much more whole being level. And now you can see also again why scorning that part of ourselves will only drive it wild. Because the more unloved you feel, the more it feeds the longing for love and the greater the desperation for it. So you've got to, and all of these kind of things that can be a kind of negative cycle or negative tape loop kind of thing, you've got to grab hold of it wherever you can and cut through it. It can be cut through at the longing point by turning that longing towards the eternal. It can be cut through at the guilt point, if one's having those longings and feeling guilty about it, by ceasing to judge oneself and choosing not to judge oneself and sit still instead. But wherever you can grab it and cut through it, you've got to grab it and cut through it. Why should hatred, why should anger come up so strongly at times? Sometimes we've all had this experience, but right now is a particularly good time to study this thing, where some little thing that normally wouldn't bother you at all drives you totally ballistic. I had that yesterday for a little while. I had this where every little thing, none of which would have bothered me normally, made me want to jump out of my skin. It didn't last. It never does last, but thank God it didn't last, because it's very unpleasant. And, you know, if anyone gets in your way at that time or anything, you just want to cream it. And then you feel bad because you know it's totally out of proportion. But what's really going on there? There's a deeper need. And that deeper need, as it works its way to the surface, you know, there's a pain in it. There's a pain in it. And often it's a grief. I mean, it always comes back to grief and then to saddened love. And that kind of pained grief can the kind of work that weighs the surface, it's incredibly, tender, easily pinged. Let's put it that way, easily pinged. And when there's a strong delusory element, easily misinterprets what's happening as another disappointment. And then, there it goes. And this is just part of being human. It is. And when you add fatigue to that, pressure, external pressure, you just add a few things, and before you know it, you know, you're acting in ways that you know, later on, you scratch your head about, what the hell was I doing there? What I did yesterday, and it's it just didn't go on all day, but it went on for a little while. I just kind of thought, well, you know, I'm going to sit tight here. Be really careful what I say and what I do right now. I'm going to be really careful. And, of course, it passed. I don't know what was going on there, but I know I don't want to lose it. Then if one does lose it, one can, you know, one needs to do sangha, okay. Sorry. Try to do better. Pick oneself up, dust oneself off, and go on. Go on. A little, you know, yesterday I talked about the basic principle of the Rim Master just drummed into us when I was a young monk. Just do your own training. Really, the whole time, you know. Just do your own training. So many different ways. Sometimes in those words, but in many, many other ways. Always bringing us back. And certainly gave an incredible example of this. Just keeping your focus on your own training. Well, I'm really talking about the same thing today. Because if you take these external attractions and external irritants as a reality and get caught up in them, in the concern about them, then you'll get pulled outside yourself. You won't be doing your own training, and that's where you go splat. And it's funny that, you know, the place where, and this is one of the killer dealers in this, you think, well, you know, sex and anger, I don't want to go, you know, accost someone, or, you know, entice or accost or confront someone in a sexual way, and I don't want to kind of wield the spiritual machete and go in there and chop people to pieces in anger and hatred. But we can easily underestimate the kind of delusory content of these things, and the way that people use often, maybe even usually, but certainly often get sucked in. It's actually, we often get sucked into those things through trying to help, peculiarly enough. Someone tries to help someone, and what started out as compassion with maybe a touch of pity turns into attraction. Someone tries to help someone, and it turns out they don't particularly want to be helped. It turns into anger. So there's a delusory component we have to watch for. Mara knows us really well. So we need to know, come to know Mara really well. just do your own training. It's beyond helping and being helped. It's beyond attraction and repulsion. It's beyond love and hate. It's just do that which needs to be done now. And do it as an offering to the eternal. Just as out of a generous heart. And let the eternal take care of the good that it does in the world, or doesn't do. As Room Master told me years ago, don't try to be Kanzeon. You can't be Kanzeon. Just train yourself and be content with that. In addition to sex and anger, I'll throw another one in that, especially at a time like this, is particularly problematical. And that is doubt and confusion. And I think of doubt and confusion really as kind of doubt slash confusion. I've been thinking of them that way for quite a while now. But doubt slash confusion. There are two aspects of delusion. You see, we're talking about greed, hate, and delusion. Sex, greed, anger, hate, doubt, and confusion, delusion. And the best thing I ever learned about doubt is just what really came up in meditation, just as a caution to me, many years ago. All doubt is rooted in self-doubt. All doubt is rooted in self-doubt. So, if you start down the doubt road, just remind yourself, this is really just self-doubt. And I need to just draw back to just what's my training. Let other people do their training. As soon as we get out there and try to figure out what other people should do and shouldn't do, we're really a sitting duck for doubt. When our focus is just on what we need to do next, the next thing we need to do, what's my training now? What's the next step I need to take? There isn't much room for it there, frankly. And if it does come up, it's much more clearly self-doubt. Once doubt gets externalized and projected that the problem's with someone else, well, then there's nothing we can do, really. Because the only person we can do anything about is ourselves. That does not mean, of course, one has to be practical. It doesn't mean that sometimes we don't need to know that someone's doing something that we ourselves don't want to join in with. If it's just kept at that level, that's not doubt. That's just a recognition of, I don't want to do that. That's not my path. When it starts going beyond that, then it can turn into doubt. And why question another person's Buddha nature? Which is what it can end up in, what it will end up in if it goes far enough. For that matter, why question one's own Buddha nature? So if you see someone else doing something that you in some way need to say no to, then in the way that is appropriate at that time, say no and don't carry it further. Easy to talk about at a dispassionate moment, not so easy to do when the fur is flying, so to speak. And the last thing I want to say here is just another really very practical point. That and another point that I many times our master talked about. She used to say, don't spread yourself. And what she meant by that is don't take on more than you can realistically handle. And don't kind of pile it on yourself. Don't pile on yourself obligations or imagined obligations that are not based in a real need. For those who are listening to these talks outside the monastery, you know, two of the classic areas where this often, where people often get caught in this is in just their relationship with their family and friends. That many people, out of kind of misguided compassion, sometimes out of guilt, will simply assume a whole load of imagined responsibilities that really aren't theirs at all with regard to family and friends. If you want to be a contemplative, either in a monastery or in the world, and to the degree to which you can be a contemplative in the world, you have to be able to live within your own center and trust that other people are capable of that too. And remember, however much you may love people, you can't live their lives for them. Within the monastery, I've never been in a temple where there wasn't twice as much to do as people can do. There's always more to do than you can do. Everywhere you look, there's things to do. Do the things that you can do and responsibly leave or get help with the things that you can't do. Otherwise, with the very best of intention, it is with the best of intentions, we drive ourselves crazy. And then we wonder why everything bugs us. When I started training, I really started with a heavy, heavy load of guilt. And it had to come off. There's so much guilt and self-judgment. It just had to come off in layers. Now, I'm not saying it's all gone by any means, by the way. I'm not saying that. But in the first couple years of my training, I very consciously, once I became aware of that I had so much guilt, I very consciously started working on just refraining from being so hard on myself in my mind. But for years, I would drive myself, and while I was driving myself, blame someone else in my mind, be complaining in my mind. But it was me that was driving myself. You know, a complaining mind is really a hell. That's what I learned from that. And the only answer one has to have compassion for oneself, one has to find what is genuine compassion for oneself, which can take some learning, frankly. And one has to learn to exercise it. Okay. Shri the Buddha, Shri the Dharma, Shri the Sangha.